From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, sitting in for Terry Gross. Long before police procedural shows were a staple on TV, writer Evan Hunter, under the pen name Ed McBain, was writing about the inner workings of the 87th Precinct in a series of popular mystery novels. Hunter died Wednesday at 78. On today's Fresh Air, we feature interviews with Evan Hunter. He also wrote the novel Blackboard Jungle and the screenplay for The Birds. Also, the film Kinsey is out on DVD. We'll hear from its director and screenwriter, Bill Condon. And rock historian Ed Ward recalls the first year of Smokey Robinson and the Miracles. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, TV critic for the New York Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. Fridays at Fresh Air are devoted to archive interviews, tapes of conversations retrieved from the vault because of some renewed relevance. Today, we'll remember one of America's most popular novelists, Evan Hunter, who died earlier this week. Under the pen name Ed McBain, Hunter wrote more than 50 books pioneering the modern police precinct novel. Hunter also wrote the screenplay for Alfred Hitchcock's The Birds. But first, we want to note yesterday's events in London. This is the sort of important, devastating story where the facts, as well as the ramifications, emerge slowly. As a TV critic, I'd especially urge viewers looking for continuing coverage to seek out the newscasts from the BBC. They're available several times daily on the cable network BBC America, and also televised by many public television stations. The BBC coverage is full of spirit and bravery, as well as outrage and reassurance, and it's really something to see. Now to Evan Hunter, who died Wednesday of cancer at age 78. Hunter wrote the book The Blackboard Jungle, a partly autobiographical novel about an idealistic young teacher shocked by conditions at an inner-city high school. He wrote screenplays for Hollywood, including an adaptation of Daphne du Maurier's The Birds for Alfred Hitchcock. And he wrote scores of novels under several different pen names as well as his own. Most famously, he wrote 55 novels as Ed McBain, a series of police novels set in the 87th Precinct. The last of them, Fiddlers, has yet to be published. The first of them, Cop Hater, came out in 1956, just under 50 years ago. It established a new genre in crime fiction, set in the squad room, evoking a fresh sense of realism in its portrayal of criminals, cops, and crimes. Many subsequent novels and TV shows, from Joseph Wambaugh's cop thrillers to Hill Street Blues, owe a large debt to Hunter's imagination and writing style. Terry first spoke with Evan Hunter in 1987. He told her he had tried out other genres before settling into writing about crime and the police.
When I first began writing, I tried my hand at every sort of fiction that the pulps were publishing. I did westerns and adventure stories and science fiction and sports stories and some detective stories. And I also tried a few what have come to be known as police procedurals, where a policeman or a group of policemen were the heroes. And I decided back then that the only valid people to deal with a crime, especially a crime as serious as murder, were cops. If you come home and find your wife slaughtered in her bed, you don't call the little old lady next door and interrupt her knitting so she can come out and solve the crime as she does in many amateur detective novels. You may call your lawyer, but certainly not to solve the crime. You'll call him to inform you that your wife is dead in bed, and he'll say, "Did you do it?" And if you say no, he'll say, "Then call the police right away. I'll be right there."
You know, I figure one of the big differences between private detective novels and police procedurals is that the private detective has decided to work outside of the system and is usually a loner, whereas in the police novel, they're obviously having to work within the system.
Yeah, even more than that, the cops in the Private Eye novel are the heavies for the most part.
That's right.
Cops would leave the Private Eye alone, he'd have this thing solved in 5 minutes, but they're interrupting him and bothering him, and so he can't get his work done. But I suppose he is a loner. He's not outside the law. You know, Private Eyes are entirely legal, and they have licenses to practice their art. And
they're outside the bureaucracy.
Yeah, and they really are out of their... They're over their heads when it comes to solving murders, because they're not supposed to be solving murders. You know, they're supposed to be... doing skip tracing and adultery cases and insurance frauds and things like that.
The first novel that you wrote that really got national attention was Blackboard Jungle, which was made into a movie of the same name. Now, you taught in a vocational school for a few months when you were young. Is Blackboard Jungle based at all on your experiences as a teacher in New York?
Oh, sure. On my experiences and the experience of other people with whom I had gone to college and who were now teaching in the system and who were bringing home to me atrocity stories about what they were experiencing around the city.
Did you feel that you weren't quite tough enough to handle some of your students?
Tough enough? I felt as if I were a man standing on a street corner throwing gold coins in the air and no one was picking them up. And I worked very hard preparing for class each day, and I would go in, and it was the most shattering experience I've ever had in my life to try to reach these kids and not be able to, because I knew I had something to give them, and I couldn't give it. I was either ill-prepared to do the job or lacking in some other way, but I was unable to reach the kids, and it was a frustrating experience. I would go home at the end of the day, I was almost on the edge of tears. So I guess maybe I wasn't tough enough.
You know, I'll tell you, I haven't read your novel, but I have seen the movie. And my favorite scene in the movie, and I wonder if you wrote this into the novel or not, is the scene where one of the teachers brings in his jazz record collection and wants to play them the Jazz Me Blues, Bix Beiderbecke's record, and they shatter his whole record collection. Yeah. And he is just heartbroken.
Yeah,
I think it's such a great scene. Did you write that scene?
Oh, sure.
Did that happen to you or someone you knew?
No, it didn't happen to me. I forget. It happened to someone. It's all very hazy now because that was a long time ago, you know. But I think it happened to a friend of mine who brought his jazz collection to school, and I don't think they broke all the records. I think they broke one of them.
Yeah, in the movie, they throw them all over the room. Yeah, they break them all because the students think that kind of jazz is really square and that the only hip thing is rock and roll.
Yeah.
You know, you're a jazz pianist, right? Or you used to be?
Oh, boy. Is that an overstatement?
A hobbyist.
I used to play in a swing band when I was a kid, when I was in my teens, you know. I used to play piano, but really, I am the world's worst piano player. The world's worst. And I no longer even say I play piano. I never go near it. I just stay far away from it. But you see, that's why I become a novelist, because I wrote Streets of Gold, and the hero of Streets of Gold is a marvelous jazz pianist.
Living out your fantasy through other characters.
Exactly.
Evan Hunter, speaking to Terry Gross in 1987. Here's that scene from the film Blackboard Jungle they were discussing.
Hey, what'd you get there, teacher?
It was music.
Wasn't that music you just had on that teacher?
For the next class.
Oh, well, what's the matter with this class?
How's it this, jockey?
Look at your records.
All right, just keep your hands off the records.
Beg your pardon?
Come on, T, swing it. Play something.
No, Joshua's got a test for us. Right, Josh?
You see, music is based on mathematics, and it's just that the next class is a little more advanced.
Well, we're advanced, Teach. Yeah. 2 times 2 is 4.
R4.
Besides, haven't you heard that music is soothing for the savage beasts?
All right, take your seats.
We're just crazy about music, ain't we?
Read, boy.
Hey, Mr. Edwards, why don't play a record, and then we'll all take the test, huh?
Sure, please.
Oh, come on, Teach.
Well, all right. This is kind of a rare one. This is Bix Beiderbecke doing Jazz Me Blues.
Ah, how about some bop?
Yeah, bop is Teach.
Listen to this. Pay attention to that cornet. Beiderbecke came before James and Elman and Steve.
How about Frank Sinatra?
Yeah, Frankie, baby.
Ah, Joni James.
Come on, get with it, man, eh?
He's got your boogie.
All right, keep away from the records. Give me the record.
Sure, Teach.
This is Cherokee. Anybody want to hear this record, huh?
A scene from the film Blackboard Jungle, based on the novel by Evan Hunter, who died earlier this week. Hunter came back for a second interview on Fresh Air in 1999, by which time he had written many more novels and received a Lifetime Achievement Award from the Mystery Writers of America.
Did you think your audience's expectations have changed since the 50s in the amount of violence or suspense, the kind of language that they expect to read?
They've grown used to that. You know, when I wrote The Blackboard Jungle, I had to change the F word to friggin', you know, which was nice and clean. And you wouldn't dream of doing that today. And indeed, you can't go into a movie theater without your friendly neighborhood cleric using the word or your grandmother. when I started the 87 Precinct series, I was a so-called serious novelist. At least, you know, I had written several books that dealt with themes other than people killing each other, and they the writing in mysteries at that time was at a very low level, and I thought what I would like to do is to bring to the mystery novel the same novelistic skills I would bring to a so-called serious novel. And I did that, and I think if I taught anything to mystery writers out there, it was that they could dare to write well. You know, gee, I can write well in a mystery and I won't be punished by having stones thrown at me or something. And I think the writing, the level of writing in the mystery novel overall is better today. And I think the mystery reader expects good writing, and if he doesn't get it, will throw the book across the room and say goodbye.
Why have you stuck with not only this genre for so long, but this particular series for so long?
Oh, I find it endlessly fascinating. I find the reasons people find to hurt each other and to justify their hurting of each other are endlessly fascinating. And I feel that the characters in the series are... I keep discovering new things about them each time, so that each book in the series is a fresh entity that stands alone, and that the reader can find something in, even if he's a first-time reader. I love writing about these guys. I love them and the women in their lives, and I just love writing about them. I would never stop.
Have you ever been the victim of a crime?
No. I'm thinking, no.
That's really interesting that after writing about crime for over 40 years,
I've talked to a lot of victims of crimes, you know. And I've seen a lot of victims of crimes, and I've seen them on the sidewalk and hanging from the ceiling, and you can get a pretty good sense of what it's about. I try in the novels to understand both sides of the picture, the side of law and order, and also the side of the guy who's committing the crime. I always like to feel that there's a very thin line that, you know, if you or I need money, we'll go to a bank and ask to borrow it. The criminal will go to the bank and hold it up. And there's just a slight difference there, but it's close to it. If you or I feel we're unhappy with our mates, we'll seek a divorce. The criminal mind will say, gee, no, I'll kill her, or I'll kill him. But it's almost the flip of the coin which way it's going to go, isn't it?
I don't know why you chose the pseudonym Ed McBain back in the 50s when you started writing the 87th Precinct series, but are you ever sorry that you've been using a pseudonym since the series has lasted for so long and been so popular?
No, not really. I chose it because my editors and my agent felt that it would be damaging to my career again as a so-called serious novelist if it became known that I was also writing mystery novels. And they said you had better put a pseudonym on the novels. And in fact, it was a deep, dark secret for at least 10 years that Ed McBain was in reality Evan Hunter. I felt like Superman, you know, run into a phone booth and rip off the cloak, and there comes Evan Hunter instead of Ed McBain. And I'm not sorry I made the change. You know, we came out of the closet a long time ago, and they knew that I was Ed McBain. But I sometimes wonder if it wouldn't have helped mystery writers everywhere if I had played it straight from the beginning. You know, if they had known that a serious novelist was writing mystery novels, that there was not any taint to writing mysteries. You know, I know deep in my soul, and so does Patricia Cornwell and John Grisham and anyone plying the trade, that they are never, ever, 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 ever going to get the Nobel Prize or the Pulitzer or the Booker or the Prix Goncourt. Never, ever, ever. You know, they may get the Mystery Writers of America Prize, but that's it, kids.
But you wish you'd said that as a writer you take the genre seriously and you take your books about crime seriously.
I do indeed. Well, they're about life and death, aren't they? I mean, what could be more serious than that?
Evan Hunter, speaking to Terry Gross in 1999. More after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Ah!
We're remembering writer Evan Hunter, who died Wednesday at the age of 78. Hunter also wrote the screenplay for Alfred Hitchcock's The Birds, which was adapted from a novella by Daphne du Maurier. The Birds takes place in an isolated seaside California village, which is experiencing bizarre and ever more threatening bird attacks. Here's a scene from the film.
Now, maybe we're all getting a little carried away by this. Admittedly, a few birds did act strange, but that's no reason to believe.
I keep telling you, this isn't a few birds. These are gulls, crows, swifts.
I have never known birds of different species to flock together. The very concept is unimaginable. Why, if that happened, we wouldn't have a chance. How could we possibly hope to fight them?
We couldn't, you're right. You're right, Mrs. Bundy.
What's the matter? Something wrong out here?
We're fighting a war, Sam.
A war? Against who?
Against birds.
I'm glad you all think this is so amusing. Frighten the children half out of their wits. If the young lady said she saw the attack at a school, why don't you believe her?
What attack? Who attacked the school?
Birds did. Crows. You're all sitting around here debating. What do you want them to do next? Crash through that window?
Mommy.
Shh. Put on your coat. Why don't you all go home? Lock your doors and windows. What's the fastest way to San Francisco?
The freeway, ma'am.
How do I find it?
I'm going out that way, lady. You can follow me.
Well, then let's leave now.
Now, do you feel like you learn things about building suspense by working on The Birds with Hitchcock?
Yeah, he was very good. He was very good on suspense, and he was very good on detail. You know, it was amazing. I'd be in the middle of discussing a scene with him, and he would say out of the blue, well, how long has she been in San Francisco now? How long has she been in Bodega Bay? And I would say, well, I don't know, 2 days. And he'd say, well, has she called her father? And I'd say, what? He said, has she called her father? I said, no, she hasn't. He said, well, don't you think she should call her father? Tell him where she is, you know? And I said, sure, you know. So it's easy to do a phone call to Papa. Or things like, I'll remember this always, when I described the scene to him where she goes up to the attic. I don't know if you recall the movie where there's been a big bird attack on the house, and they're all sitting around, and Mitch is asleep in the chair, and she's asleep in the other chair, and she hears a sound, and she looks up, she leans over to Mitch, and he doesn't hear her because he's asleep. And she grabs a flashlight and goes to investigate. And I'm describing the scene to him. And this, to me, by the way, it didn't turn out to be this in the film itself. But in the screenplay, when she opens a door to that attic, there's every bird imaginable to mankind in that room. I mean, there are hawks, there are eagles, there are seagulls, there are anything you could imagine is in that room. When her eyes pan that room, we see all the birds in the universe in that room, and we know right at that moment that this is a unified attack against human beings and not something we're playing around with here in Bodega Bay. It didn't turn out that way. In the film, he just used crows and seagulls. But I described the scene to him, and she goes up the stairs, and she hesitates, and then she opens the door, and all these birds are in there. And he was silent for a while, and then he said, let me see if I have this correctly, Evan. And I said, yeah. And I told him, he said, there's been this massive bird attack on the house. I said, yes, there has. He said, and now she hears a sound, and Mitch is asleep, so she doesn't want to wake him up. I said, yes. So she goes to investigate by herself. Have I got that correct? I said, yes. He says, well, is the girl daft? You know. So I said, well, you know, I realized he had me. And he said, we'll take the curse off it. He said, we'll have her first go into the kitchen and spot the lovebirds in the cage, and this makes her feel a bit more complacent about it. And then we'll have her along the way open some other doors, and she'll see that everything's okay, and we'll lull the audience until she opens that final door, and boom, there are all the birds.
Now, did you enjoy working with Hitchcock?
Oh, yeah. Well, he was wonderful. He was like He was like the father every boy wished he could have. You know, he was, I think, approximately twice my age while we were working on the film, and in good health and good spirits, and felt, told me many, many times that he felt he was entering the golden age of making films, his golden age of making films. He had just come off the success of Psycho, you have to understand, and was looking forward to Birds being an even bigger success. And but he was humorous, he was anecdotal, he was generous, he with his time and with his patience, and you know, I was a new kid on the block out there in many, many respects, and he was he took me under his wing. Not to use a metaphor.
And then attacks you.
Evan Hunter, speaking to Terry Gross in 1999. He died earlier this week. He was 78. His final novel, published under the name Ed McBain, the 55th and final book in his 87th Precinct series, is called Fiddlers. It will be published posthumously this September, followed in 2006 by a collection of short stories spanning Hunter's entire career. I'm David Bean Cooley, and this is Fresh Air. Major funding for Fresh Air comes from this and other NPR member stations, and from Barnes & Noble, publishers of Portable Professor Audio Courses, which include Everything You've Been Taught Is Wrong by James Lowen, author of Lies My Teacher Told Me. Additional support for NPR comes from Bantam Books, publisher of Locked Rooms, a new novel of suspense by Laurie R. King featuring Mary Russell and Sherlock Holmes. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Coming up, making a movie about Alfred Kinsey. We talk with screenwriter and director Bill Condon about his film Kinsey, which is now out on DVD. Also, Ed Ward remembers when Smokey Robinson and the Miracles were Bill Robinson and the Matadors. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley, in for Terry Gross. Our next guest, Bill Condon, wrote and directed the film Kinsey, based on the life of Alfred Kinsey, who conducted groundbreaking research into human sexuality. The film has recently come out on DVD. In the 40s, Kinsey was a biology professor who studied the gall wasp and found that no two wasps were the same. Each was unique. He decided to expand his research to humans, specifically to the scientific study of human sexuality, a subject that was considered taboo. His 1948 book, Sexual Behavior in the Human Male, was based on thousands of interviews with people about the most intimate parts of their lives. He followed that up with a book about female sexuality. His work was enormously controversial in its time and remains so among those people who believe he opened the door to sexual amorality. Here's a scene from Kinsey, after Alfred Kinsey has decided to investigate human sexuality and teach a course on marriage. He's in the classroom. Kinsey is played by Liam Neeson.
Why offer a marriage course? Because society has interfered with what should be a normal biological development, causing a scandalous delay of sexual activity. which leads to sexual difficulty in early marriage. In an uninhibited society, a 12-year-old would know most of the biology, which I will have to give you in formal lectures. So, let's start with the 6 stages of the coital sequence. Both sexes experience all 6 stages equally. Stimulation. Who can tell me which part of the human body can enlarge 100 times? Miss.
I'm sure I don't know. And you've no right to ask me such a question in a mixed class.
I was referring to the pupil of your eye, young lady. And I think I should tell you, you're in for a terrible disappointment.
Terry Gross spoke with Bill Condon last year. A warning to parents, you might not find this interview appropriate for children. Terry asked Condon how Kinsey got people to respond candidly to his questionnaire about their sexual history when they would be unlikely to feel comfortable discussing such an intimate subject with friends or spouses.
One of the most original things about the methodology was that he always assumed you had done everything. So it was never, have you ever, you know, masturbated? It was, when was the first time you masturbated? With every question, the burden of kind of admission was taken off of you. It was just assumed you had done it all. So there was an extremely non-judgmental approach. He also had these ways of bringing the questions back to the same place over and over again and really being able to test whether your answers were consistent, you know. So he worked in a lot of tripwires to weed out the liars and the exaggerators, which of course is one of the real problems with taking sex histories. And you know, in general, having collected these 8 million gall wasps, he was trying to apply the same idea to sex. If I can just get more than anybody else, his aim was to get 100,000. He actually wound up getting about 28,000, but that's still more than anybody had or has since then.
You know, do you think that even though he got thousands and thousands of people to respond to his survey, do you think that they were a representative sample of either Americans or of people in general in their approaches to sex?
Well, it's interesting. You know, I think, first of all, it's nothing more than a snapshot of the country at the time, you know, so that the male volume really represents men during World War II,
mm-hmm.
And the female that and a little later. He'd solved one of the big challenges facing sex researchers, but in doing so created another problem. You know, the challenge was inevitably somebody who's going to talk to you about his or her sex life is probably more sexually comfortable and active than people who won't. So therefore, you know, the data might already be skewed in a certain direction. He came up with this idea with the help actually of Ray Kroc's brother, the founder of McDonald's, that they would get 100% groups. They would get people who'd gotten together for a reason that had nothing to do with sex, a bowling league or a lady sewing circle, and get 100% of those people to give their sex histories, actually using tactics that, you know, no one could get away with today. You know, the first 40 or 50% would fall in pretty easily. Then he'd use them to convince, you know, the next 20 or 30%. And the holdouts really were subjected to threats. They were no longer going to be in the bowling league or the sewing circle and late night phone calls until finally everybody agreed to do it. So
talk about peer pressure.
Exactly. So he felt, if I just get enough of these groups, then it has to all add up to a kind of representative sample of America. And of course, that wasn't true. You know, he oversampled in certain groups. He, you know, too many inmate histories, for example, something that he corrected in the female volume. Everybody always raises this issue of 10% males being homosexual, you know, and Kinsey actually never said that. Kinsey actually thought, again, for him, homosexual was an adjective describing acts. He thought on the 6th end of his scale, people who were involved in exclusively homosexual acts, that was anywhere from 2 to 4% of the population, which basically falls in line with what people think today. What he did say was that 10% of the population had exclusively homosexual activity for 3 years in their adulthood. Now, you have to remember, again, snapshot of a time and a place. This is America during wartime, A, and B, at a time when most schools were single sex. So these are things that wouldn't apply today. But that's an example of something where a strict look at his data comes up with basically the same result as what people come up with today.
One of the questions that you have him asking in the movie, a question I really like that isn't directly related to sex, is this: how young were you when you no longer
yes.
thought of your parents' home as your own? And there's two things I really like about that question. One is that it doesn't say how old were you, it says
yes.
how young were you.
Yeah.
And the other is that, like, what a really interesting question to ask. Like, at what point did you realize this is no longer what you're about, or the
exactly.
center of your life? You've moved on to becoming an adult person, a differentiated person.
I know. I love that question too, and it was obviously a real find for when I was writing the script, because it allows you to sort of deal with so much in the context of sexuality. And that's what he would do. He would ease in with these biographical questions and then slowly start to expand, so that you got a question like that that isn't directly about sex, but in some basic way is, because
mm-hmm.
obviously that differentiation does happen during adolescence, during the onset of adolescence.
Now, you interviewed one of Kinsey's researchers as background
yes.
for the screenplay. What are some of the things, which researcher was it, and what were some of the things
yeah.
you learned either about the researcher or about Kinsey's own life?
It was Paul Gebhardt, the character played by Tim Hutton in the movie. You know, the thing that struck me more than anything about him was the absolute sense of openness and the non-judgmental nature of talking to him. Here I was in this sort of awkward position of interviewing the ultimate interviewer and having to ask, pretty jump in and ask some pretty, intimate questions. What was sex night like at the Kinseys, for example? And he was so matter-of-fact about it all, about the affair that he'd had with one of the other researchers' wives when he first arrived in Bloomington, the effect that had on his marriage. It was, again, so open that I really got a glimpse into how these guys pulled it off,
What is sex night at the Kinseys?
It wasn't that frequent, but they did get into Kinsey, did start to promote this idea of open marriages. And Kinsey's somebody who fell into this study, started talking to people about sex, traveling the country talking to them about it, then started observing it, then started filming it, and then finally sort of, went into this to this further point of kind of trying to actually create this sexual, I wouldn't call it utopia, but a certain sexual environment where everything would be open, kind of a swinger way before his time,
This is one of the things that a lot of people find very troubling about his life, because, he's not exactly like the dispassionate scientist just observing behavior under the microscope. He's trying out a lot of things himself, a lot of things that were perceived as definitely violating, the moral code of the time.
That's correct. And I think that's the trouble I think people get into, they very quickly then say that the work was agenda driven, for example. And there's I really have found no proof for that idea. His first passion was science. The idea of having collected these gall wasps and that he could collect as many human beings was for him more important than anything. Work was more important than anything, And I think, it's a problem that people who work in this area really face, because everyone sort of applies their own kind of code to other people's behavior. So especially when they hear that he was actually having all this extracurricular activity, there's immediately people leap to the conclusion that that's what the whole point of it was. And there's really that is not the case.
The way you portray him in the movie, he's somebody who is very scientifically interested in sex and becomes very interested in the pursuit of sex himself, but that the way you portray him, he's kind of emotionally tone deaf to
yeah.
To the consequences that sex can have. For instance, if you're married and then you have relations with somebody outside of that marriage,
yes.
your spouse is likely to be upset, and he's a little uncomprehending about those kinds of emotional consequences. Is that based on research that you did about him?
Absolutely. Uncomprehending, impatient, so driven by this work. And again, these are, I think that anyone who's unsympathetic to him will find plenty in this portrait to kind of confirm that point of view. He is a complicated character, you know, a complicated person. And that was absolutely a part of it. The, you know, again, starting with the idea of studying sex scientifically, which meant for him outlets, namely orgasms, and then, you know, stripping away religion and morality and culture from that, and then extending that idea further and further into his own life until it became almost a mission with him, is something that is understandably, you know, upsetting for people. I think you have to kind of have a complicated view of the world to really kind of countenance the whole picture, you know?
Bill Condon speaking with Terry Gross. His film Kinsey is now out on DVD. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry Gross's interview with Bill Condon. He wrote and directed Kinsey, about the controversial sex researcher Alfred Kinsey.
There's a scene in the movie in which he basically does a sex survey with his
yes.
own father. And the father explains that as a way to punish him for masturbating and to prevent him from doing it further, this harness was created
yes.
for him so that he could no longer do this.
Right.
And it becomes clear in the movie that this is why... one of the reasons why he became so repressed and intolerant and was so repressive in the way he brought up his son. But although that story was told to Kinsey, it wasn't told to Kinsey by his father. It was somebody else who he was administering the survey to who told him.
That's correct.
That story.
Who also had a similar kind of repressive traits. So, that is me combining two ideas. Kinsey always wishing he'd taken his father's history and never having had a chance to do it, and speculating about something like that about his father, and then this one subject. For me, it's less about Kinsey than a whole position, you know. But the fact that there was no breakthrough with the father, that is dramatic license. There's no question.
What were the criticisms like when he was actually doing his research in the 40s and 50s?
Yeah. Well, you know, there are certain groups that were came out against him. Obviously, the attacks for the statistical methodology. Also, people like Lionel Trilling, Margaret Mead. You know, Margaret Mead, he's taken all the fun out of sex. Lionel Trilling, where's the love? You know, Gore Vidal today was talking about how he repeated that criticism that Trilling had made to him directly to Kinsey. And he said, but I can't measure love, you know, that's not what I'm about. But I think there was certainly, you know, there was, you know, the Times was never a fan. And there's a certain kind of New York intellectual crowd that never really embraced Kinsey, you know, again, thought there was something limited in the whole enterprise.
Of course, you had to face the question of how to make a movie about somebody who is very explicitly researching sex and yet get a rating that allows
yes.
people to go see the
yeah.
movie. So can you talk a little bit about the standards you set for yourself about what to show and what not to show and why you use those standards?
Sure. You know, the whole issue of the rating was a real challenge. In two ways, I have to say. First of all, I wanted to suggest just how revolutionary Kinsey was. You know, he marched into a classroom in the late 30s. In the context of all these hygiene films, and put up a slide of intercourse, of an erect penis and a vagina, you know. I wanted to both be able to show that in an R-rated movie and also to suggest just how shocking that was, you know. And the second problem I approached, you know, with a kind of classic studio style of filmmaking, so that you're in this kind of pretty academic setting and you're deep into the movie and it all feels sort of traditional, and then suddenly the slide is there. And I have been pleased to see it with audiences where the gasp that happens among the students is kind of mirrored in the audience, you know, a little bit of nervous wrestling at least. But when we shot it, I was never really sure. I had to shoot a backup of just a clinical drawing because I was never sure we'd get that past the MPAA. And we sent the movie over to them, and they called after a long day of discussion and said, we're giving you an R for pervasive sexual content, and thank you. We learned a lot. So we were all relieved.
These are more biographical questions about
sure.
you, but I'm wondering, like, did you have sex education when you were in school?
We did, actually. I went to a Jesuit high school, all boys, and I remember Father Duffy teaching us about 69 when I was probably 13. It was in the late 60s, and it was in New York, and we couldn't possibly be, as students, more rebellious than the faculty was at that moment, you know? So it was a very progressive school in that way. As I was saying to Gore Vidal today, the first book I think I read about sex was The Prisoner of Sex by Norman Mailer when I was probably 13. And, you know, he had lots of theories. In fact, Gore reminded me that it was over The Prisoner of Sex that the famous battle on the Dick Cavett show happened with Norman Mailer. But one of them was, of course, my only outlet at the time, which was masturbation, that every orgasm is, you know, that doesn't, you know, isn't implanted without a condom in a woman is another chapter of the great American novel that's just been wasted. I mean, you know, he has very specific ideas about his own fluids, I think. So I can remember, you know, that's, and it's been so interesting to me later on to read about Kinsey, and he talked about, you know, Freud reinventing sin as neurosis, you know. And for me, very early on, the sense of having grown up in a devout Catholic household, you know, there was certainly a sense of sin and shame connected with sex. Then to pick up as the first book to get over that, Norman Mailer, and hear some of this, that got, it left me completely confused.
I really like the casting in the movie, and I think Liam Neeson and Laura Linney are terrific. And just on a more trivial note, in terms of the way the film is done, Laura Linney playing Kinsey's wife is, you portray the character as somebody who isn't spending a whole lot of time thinking about how she looks. You know, her clothes are kind of haphazard and lacking in style. On the other hand, they're not so screamingly lacking in style that we'd be making fun of her. She just looks like the kind of person who isn't aware of style, doesn't really care about it. And I thought it was just exactly right. I don't know if she was that way in real life or not, but I think for the character you're portraying her as being, that she was just perfectly dressed.
Oh, well, thank you. And that's Bruce Finlayson did the costumes, and Laura Linney, who was so intent on getting that right. And it is how she was. And it's kind of what we wanted to celebrate, you know. Again, in, you know, most movies
she wasn't a vixen.
Exactly, yes. Yeah. But that's the point. It's everybody's having sex, you know, and including, you know, in movies, you don't get that sense. It's only the pretty people who are having sex, you know. But in real life, that's not the case. And so it was that, to me, one of my favorite scenes is Laura, Liam shirtless, and Peter shirtless. And before we started shooting, I said, belly's out. You know, everybody had a very ordinary body. And that's what's happening in the world.
Well, Bill Condon, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you so much, Terry.
Bill Condon speaking with Terry Gross in 2004. His film Kinsey is now out on DVD. Coming up, the early days of Smokey Robinson and the Miracles. This is Fresh Air. When Berry Gordy started Tamla and Motown Records in 1959, he'd already been around the block a couple of times. Among his ventures was managing a young singing group whose lead singer, he was sure, was going to be a star, as well as a songwriter who would provide material for the empire Gordy was hoping to build. Smokey Robinson and the Miracles learned the music business right along with the boss. A new 6-CD box set collects Motown singles from 1959 to 1961. Rock historian Ed Ward takes us through that first year of the Miracles and Motown's existence.
One of the things Berry Gordy was counting on when he started his Motown and Tamla family of labels was that there was a lot of talent in Detroit that wasn't getting heard. This wasn't exactly a gamble, because a couple of years earlier, he'd already found a teenager named Bill Robinson, who had a group called the Matadors, and he'd been working with him to develop his songwriting talents. When he thought they were ready, Gordy changed their name to the Miracles and had them cut an answer record to a current hit.
Walked all day till my feet were tired. I was low, I just couldn't get hired. Saw a sign in a grocery store. Help is light, and we need some more.
I got a job.
Gordy placed the record with End Records in New York and watched it sink, which is the fate of most answer records. But it couldn't have escaped his attention that the Miracles performance was superior to the original Get a Job by the Silhouettes, and he undoubtedly hoped his own label would be ready in time for the next Miracles record. Meanwhile, he was still thrashing around for something he could sell fast, and with the novelty song Purple People Eater selling like crazy, he and Robinson wrote a song called It, and recorded it with Ronnie White, another Miracle, as Ronnie and Bill.
I was home last night trying to read a book. There was a knock on my door, so I took a look. But when I reached the door, there was no one there. Not on the porch or anywhere, but in the dark of night, I heard a cry. Like somebody was about to die. It went up, oh, 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 oh.
Again, the song died. So, in September 1959, Gordy debuted his new label, Motown, with his first Miracles record.
She's not a bad girl because she made me see how love could be. But she
Bad Girl scraped the bottom of the pop charts, and Gordy had to lease it to Chess in Chicago in order to get national airplay. For some reason, he then turned around and released a second Miracles record, The Feeling Is So Fine, backed with You Can Depend on Me, almost immediately, then withdrew it. Smokey, as Bill Robinson was now known to everybody, had come up with a better song. Wait, withdraw that one. It would sound better with strings.
Where
It was a costly lesson. DJs were confused about which version to play, the record stalled, and that was that. You'd think Gordy would have learned a lesson, but a few months later, he did it again with the next Miracles record. This time, though, the story was a bit different. On the other side of Who's Loving You was a charming semi-novelty song called Shop Around, which the band had sort of slapped together. A month after Who's Loving You was released, though, Gordy called Smokey in the middle of the night and ordered him to assemble the group and go to the studio so they could re-record Shop Around. Groggy but determined, they did it, and Motown had its first million-selling single.
When I became of age, my mother called me to her side. She said, "Son, you're growing up now. Pretty soon you'll take a bride." And then she said, "Just because you become a young man now, it's still some things that you don't understand now. Before you ask some girl for a handout, keep your freedom for as long as you can now. My mama told me, you better shop around. Oh yeah, you better shop around. Shop around."
Ed Ward lives in Berlin. The complete Motown Singles, Volume 1, 1959-61, is on Hippo Select. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. For Terry Gross, I'm David B. Cooley.
So now, my mama told me, you better shop around. Oh, yeah, you better shop around. Shop around. I try to get yourself a bargain, son.
CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's at 1-877-213-7374. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Carnegie Corporation of New York, a foundation with a mandate from Andrew Carnegie to promote the advancement and diffusion of knowledge and understanding. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Dr. Francis Dufresne, who's in his 50s, was practicing internal medicine at Pennsylvania Hospital when he was called up by the U.S. Navy Reserve to Iraq. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Dr. Dufresne about treating the soldiers in Iraq and learning combat medicine on the fly. Join us for the next Fresh Air.